This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. Go to FUBARradio.com for more details. Tom Latcham on FUBAR Radio.
Well, we survived Blue Monday, this is the song, and that was billed as the most miserable day of the year because we all give up our diets and our resolutions and we've still got no money and we're miles away from payday and it's all miserable, but we've got through it. Unfortunately, I don't know about you, seems we're on to Tits Up Tuesday. I am experiencing Tits Up Tuesday. I don't know about you. Everything I've done this morning has gone wrong. I mean, it's all minor stuff. You know, got stuck in traffic, couldn't find a parking space. My mum died. No, she didn't die. My mum didn't die. She's still alive, unfortunately. But I will tell you another story about mum shortly. Although I did die with embarrassment with what she told me last night. I'll tell you in a bit as well. And also, unfortunately, all the newspapers are boring. So that's why I'm starting on this non-intro. But I'm here with my newspaper reviewer for the day, comedian Joe Boar, who we're trying to find, hopefully, some lightness amid the tedium to lift us on this bitterly cold January morning. Do wish us luck. Hello, Joe.
Hello, mate.
How are you doing?
We'll get there.
We will get there. Are you well?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm on my diet. I'm on my January diet. I'm on the David Bowie diet.
What's that?
Just out of respect for him.
Yeah.
Basically, I'm having heroes, but just for one day.
Can I have one?
Yeah.
It'll
just be on the heroes.
I'm also doing that. I'm on coke. Okay. I'm just sniffing coke all the time, and acting like a lunatic. Yeah. Just like David Bowie, my hero. So, how are you? Are you tired? You are now a father.
I'm a dad, fully fledged dad. He's 4 weeks old. Mm.
What's his name?
We're doing all right. His name's Milo.
No, it's a good name.
It's a good name, isn't it?
Solid name. Although, wasn't there? Oh, no, that was Mika. Mika. Okay. I was thinking that annoying pop star.
I told my mum the name, right? And my mum, she's sort of, I don't know if it's a Jewish thing, she's just got no filter, so she says whatever comes into her head. So I said, what do you think of the name? She sort of made a face, and then the next day, she texted me, and she went, I love the name, on reflection. Which is like... I think that is the worst thing to say after a compliment, on reflection.
Well, that sounds like quite an apt moment to tell you my story about my mother and what she said to me last night. This is going to make up my question of the day for you guys. Basically, I want to know, and it fits into what Joe just said, what's the most... what she said to you wasn't embarrassing, but inappropriate, perhaps?
Inappropriate, exactly.
Inappropriate. Yeah. So basically, last night I was at dinner. It was my brother's birthday. My mum was there, my dad was there, my girlfriend was there. They know each other. It's not a new thing, thankfully. Yeah. Not quite sure how we got onto it, but my mum ended up regaling us with a story about how her neighbour walked in on my dad going down on her.
Unbelievable.
And also, my mum's deaf, right? So she did a little sign where she wiped down her mouth to show that was what my dad was up to.
Was he there? Your dad was there?
My dad was there, yeah.
Smiling away, going, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, boys. I once was. Well, to be fair, you know, it all started because my brother said he'd once walked in on having sex, and they were like, well, we do that. And then she went, do you remember that time when you lost that banana?
Oh, no.
Dear man, please stop now. So I want to know, what is the most inappropriate, embarrassing thing your parents have ever done or said to you? Give us a shout. Tom@foobarradio.com. Tweet us at foobarradio, or call us on 0330 223 0200. That number is 0330 223 0200. Can you beat it? I imagine possibly not, but anyway, give it a good go. Also coming up, apart from the looking at the papers and trying to find something that's not tedious and boring, with Joe Boar, is author and former Sky News diplomatic editor Tim Marshall. He'll be talking to us about why the world appears to be locked in a never-ending conflict and whether we're headed towards World War III. He's a man in the know. He's an expert in that field, so we'll be talking to him after 11. We'll also be chatting to former England cricketer Jack Russell. Do you remember Jack Russell? Do you like cricket, Joe?
I'm not a cricket man, really.
Basically, Jack Russell, he was a...
dog. He's a dog.
He wasn't a dog. Okay. No. I don't think his name's actually Jack. Okay. He just likes the name. Yeah. He likes to be like a dog. He was a wicketkeeper and a sort of... He wouldn't wear a helmet. He would stand up right up by the stumps. He was a sort of eccentric.
Okay.
And then he went into art.
Oh, wow.
Because you do. So we'll be talking to him about the national side's current brilliant form and also plenty more besides. But I suppose we should kick off with a song, right?
Yeah, let's do it.
That is what we do here. And then we'll come back with some of the papers. The front pages, we'll try not to linger too much on them because they are all exceptionally boring. And we'll try and find a few little gems throughout. Anyway, I'm here with Joe Boar. I'm glad to say it's freezing cold. We'll try and keep you warm right through till midday here on Fubar Radio. This is the AAS. It's zero.
Shaking like a ladder to the sun. makes me feel like a madman on the run. Find me never, never far gone. So get your leather, leather, leather on.
Listen to that fancy new sting from FUBAR Radio. Ooh, wasn't that lovely?
That's the way you ended it. Ooh.
Oof. And we've got some more of those beauties where that one came from, I tell you. That other voice was Joe Bohr, comedian.
Hey.
Extraordinaire, who is going to help me through the papers, but as they're boring, let's just put them to one side. 1 second. How is the comedy going? I mean, you've obviously been a father recently, so, we know your genitals work. What about your comedy?
Comedy's working. I'm doing a show on Friday. Come along, everyone. At the Wheat Chief.
Where's that?
It's on Rathbone Place, just off Oxford Street, 7:30 on Friday.
Very good.
And it's free.
Is it?
Free,
yeah, everyone, who doesn't love freeness, especially in January?
Exactly. So, I'm trying out an hour of, it's a new show with a character I do called Jasper Cromwell Jones.
I think we've had him on the show.
I did it last time, yeah.
He wasn't a real person. You've just ruined the act.
I'm sorry.
Ruined that whole secret there, that Jasper Cromwell Jones wasn't real. It was just you.
Yeah, no, he is made up. But he's doing an hour of made up stuff on Friday, yeah, so... Yeah, come along.
Problem with that is, though, none of what he says is true. So you know, I mean, I like to go along to a comedy night and know that everything I'm being told is true.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Because all comedians, everything that's happened to them, all the stories they tell, have all happened to them. They're all exceptionally exciting, go-getting,
amazing,
this is funny people, aren't they, you know, that end up in these just wacky situations.
Yeah, this thing happened to me today. Oh.
Hold on, I've been to your gig last week. It happened to you last week as well. That's funny.
Yeah, it's happening all the time. There's a comedian, nice guy, but he says, "Oh, I've just been dumped before I came on stage," and he does that every time he goes on.
Yeah,
unless he's getting dumped every time he goes on.
Well, if he is, just give up the comedy and work on his dating skills. Probably.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
I did a comedy course myself, and there was a guy that did a lot of that. He was very good at it.
Yeah.
So I suppose play to your strengths, you know, and if that is, you know, abject misery about your pathetic love life, then so be it. You know, you've got to roll with the punches, right?
Tragedy and comedy, they go hand in hand, I think.
as you know, by knowing lots of comedians who are largely tragic characters.
I'll tell you what, it really helped getting, I got dumped by text and I just read it out on stage. And I was at such a low point in my life and everyone laughed. And I couldn't believe it. I remember saying to a mate, "Oh, this look at this text she sent," and he went, "That's really, really funny." No, you're too close to it. and I did it. It really kicked off my comedy career.
Really,
getting dumped. It's the best thing that's ever happened to me.
Really?
Yeah, I'm over it.
You should thank her.
I moved on.
Do you still know her?
Sort of.
Friends on Facebook?
I think she defriended me on Facebook.
Right. Because of that?
I think so. Yeah, I'd done it on TV. I read out the text on TV because I know it off by heart. I was really going to call you tonight to talk to you. Just want to start by saying it's nothing to do with anyone else, honey. I've not seen anyone. I just want what is it? No, just not seen anyone. I need to check it out.
Oh, he's it. It'll be better than this on Friday at the Wheat Sheaf. You'd hope.
Let me find it.
Okay, he'll find it. But what it does actually, while we're on it, there are some of the stories in the paper today that I've noticed that this sort of reminds me of the rise of half night stands because of Tinder and that sort of stuff. You know, people and there's a story in the Sun today. It's a feature in the Sun about how people are now doing half night stands because they don't like to do the walk of shame in the morning, so they just do it at night instead, when no one's around. And there's a big feature with people talking about it. So let's see if I can find it in here.
So what time do you leave?
Just whenever you want, really.
Okay. And then you go on to another one, and then...
So, I mean, there's this woman. She sounds lovely. her name, Rara Armstrong. She's a mother of one and a former model. She says, "There's nothing as humiliating as fumbling about in the bottom of your bed for your pants after a brief bout of disappointing sex with a guy you've only just met.
Yeah.
This happened to me recently. I met a guy in a bar and quite fancied him. One thing led to another and I ended up back at his place. Sadly, he turned out to have a micropenis and it lasted 20 seconds. So she left. She said, "One of the joys of the half night stand is that you can wake up in your own bed and pretend the whole thing was just a bad dream."
Is that the one who... That is the girl who texted me. I recognise her.
I wonder where she went that night.
Stop, mate. 30 seconds.
She said, "I don't think that people are very interested in relationships anymore. That culture is gone. It's no longer about finding the one. It's about finding the right one for tonight." Rara, I don't... You obviously weren't paying attention in biology lessons, but kind of... The sexual relationship and having children together and not just shagging for a night is kind of crucial to the future of humankind.
Yeah, she's very brave.
And she is brave, or stupid. And she says, "Sex has become disposable. You do it, then you get out as quickly as possible. Get home and share the experience with your friends on Facebook or Instagram as a laugh."
People are so...
Or the Sun.
yeah. People are so rude nowadays dating. Like they just, my mates who are doing it are telling me how they just don't get back to them.
Mm.
And women are the ones with more power than ever, I think.
Well, let's... the rise of Tinder... It isn't necessarily the reason for half... I have had half-night stands in the past, Joe, and the reason was... I I went out with. I used to go out with this girl, and she split up with me, and she was the first love of my life. Right,
we're getting deep. We are getting deep.
But I've just taken my jumper off. No one, you know, there's a
lucky
big one.
It's just the jumper.
You know, there's a big one coming. I've just got my boobs out. Yeah. This girl dumped me. She was the love of my life, and I really wasn't ready to sort of go back into the world of dating, as they say. And but I did. I tried it, and I sort of dated this girl. She lived in. I met her at a club, and we went back to her place. She lived in Newington Green or something in London, and I sort of had sex with her, and then
sort of had sex.
I did have sex with her. Yeah, and then and then I just sort of was lying in bed. I don't really like staying in other people's places anyway. Yeah. And I just got this awful, horrible thing of like, I don't really want to be here at all. So about 3 a.m, I just got up and went, I'm going home. See you later. And I left and went home. And then I felt really guilty and bad. So I'd still had a number and everything. So I texted her to meet up with her again. I was like, I'm really sorry about that. Like, I'm having a bit of a tough time in my life. You know, I'm really sorry. Would you fancy going out for a date again? She's like, yeah, okay, yeah. So we went out and we went to her house and we watched a video and then we had sex again. Yeah. And then I did it again.
Did it again?
I know. I just ran off at 4 a.m. again. And I was like, I'm really sorry.
You're like the milk tray man. In a way.
Like a really bad milk tray man. I didn't bring her chocolates. I just bought her abject misery and then did one.
I've got a sort of a fellow depressing.
Yeah, let's do it. Story.
Let's do it, mate. I don't know. Internet dating's weird. My ex, because I had a similar thing where I was in a relationship for 7 years, and you know, she was great, and we split up, and then she found someone on Match.com. I found out she'd found someone on Match.com. So I was like, right, I'm going to find someone on Match.com. So I went on Match.com, right? And then Match.com's got this thing where it matches you up, like, percentage-wise with someone else. Mm. It says you are 90% match with this person. Mm. And that happened. And a picture came up. It said you're 90% match with... And it was my ex-girlfriend.
Really? That's a sign.
And I was pretty mental at that point. So I was calling her up going, see, the computer wants us to be together. That is depressing, isn't it?
That's computer says no, Joe.
she said no. Oh God! Wish I'd have shared that.
But you know, you're now in a loving. Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, you're in a relationship.
You're absolutely right. I mean, it was loving until we had the kid.
Yeah.
Now it's just miserable. A lot of shouting. You hold him. No, you hold him. I never liked the name.
My mum said too. She didn't like the name either.
Yeah. On reflection.
Right, so I tell you, we should probably have a look at some of the front pages. We'll do it briefly, because to be honest, they're a bit boring and also not that cheery. So what does the Mirror say this morning, Joe Bohr?
Another musician's died in his late 60s.
Yes, it's the Eagles star Glenn. I don't know. I don't even know the Eagles at all. Frey, the Eagles guitarist. I'm not a big Eagles fan. Are you? No.
It's a similar thing with the whole David Bowie. I really like David Bowie, but I don't share the passion of all my mates on Facebook. Really, yeah. And I feel like whenever everyone's put it on Facebook and Twitter, it's been said, you know, R.I.P. You know, and I feel like I'm just sort of copying everyone else.
Yeah.
Even though obviously, you know, it is sad. Saucy snap that put me off net dating. That's something different. That is Sherry from Loose Women.
it's a biggie. On the hold the front page there, Daily Mirror. Sherry Hewson has been sent a cockpick. That's basically what that story says.
Yeah, yeah. She stopped. Yes. She stopped with the dating.
No, it's put her off. Sad news for all those men out there. Sherry Hewson is no longer internet dating.
I tried internet dating, and an advert popped up on my computer, and it went, click here to date girls in your area. I clicked there. I got a virus, which is typical of the girls in my area.
You've used that one before, haven't you?
I have, yeah.
I've been to one of your sets, Joe. I think you put it in there.
I put it out of the bag, mate.
It also says, stem cell miracle. A revolutionary stem cell trial in Britain has helped paralysed MS patients walk again, which is obviously great news, if not the most exciting front page, but great news.
Yeah, yeah.
The Sun. What does The Sun say, Joe Bohr?
Crack shot. Probed by crackpots. Such a sun headline.
What does that mean, though?
Hero kills Iraqi firing grenades at British base. Sniper is investigated for failing to warn him. British sniper is being probed.
Surely if you warn someone that you're just about to shoot with a sniper, rifle, they'll just move, right?
Yeah, there's a scary...
Oh, thanks for the warning. See you later then.
Cheers, mate.
Cheers. And you're free to carry on your grenade throwing ways into another day.
So a guy has killed, a guy, Iraqi.
Yeah. And basically he's in trouble now with the the Iraqi, the sort of the ones that look at sort of old crime, potential crimes. He's sort of being investigated for that.
Isn't that the sort of thing that happens all the time?
I think that there's apparently there's rules in war. It seems bizarre, but there are rules.
Don't touch the face.
There are, only hit between the the chest. Only hit between the chest and the body. No low blows.
No low blows.
Yeah,
got a meeting the next day.
Say tell me if you're about to shoot me with a sniper rifle, etc. etc. etc.
Yeah. Wow.
Well, there's a lot of people going after. I don't know. There's a lot of stories at the moment about people hounding people in the forces who've acted in certain ways. And while I have sympathy for anybody who's put in that situation, you also have to, you know, we're the best army in the world, right? We have to act in the professional manner. That would be my opinion, but who knows? So I won't do the Daily Mail because it's about dementia and it's not that cheery, but the Daily Telegraph, the Daily Telegraph, actually, the business section of the Daily Telegraph that you have there.
I never read the business section.
Well, nor do I, but it was on the front. It was on the front page. They did a little brief breakout on the front page about this, so I read it, and it's quite interesting. What does it say, Joe Gore?
Is there? There's a thing about insurers take aim at driverless car threat.
Mm.
So, driverless cars are expected to lead to a dramatic reduction in accidents. Yeah, the ramifications.
The insurance firms are going to be, not a great deal of sympathy for the multi-billion pound insurance industry. But, it's going to completely... screw them, which is why the Daily Telegraph business section says they're coming together to shake up the way that the insurance... sector is done, and actually more people they won't be suing the people, they'll be suing the manufacturers of the driverless cars, because people will just be sitting in cars doing nothing, so it's not their fault.
Yeah, I mean, how soon is this going to, come in?
Who knows? I mean, they exist already. I mean, did you see the other day? There was like a Sky News thing. Even ISIS have got driverless cars. Honestly, no. There was a video of them testing out driverless cars, and they said,
"I haven't even got a driverless car."
I know, and I don't. You know, we live in houses. You know, we live in a sort of a civilized nation where we don't throw gay people off buildings or live in mud huts.
Yeah, no,
we haven't even got driverless cars.
Yeah, that is
not fair. I'm moving to Syria. I want a driverless car, and I don't care what I have to do or how many gays I have to throw off buildings to do it. I'm moving to Syria. Right, anyway, let's...
But the ramifications of it, no one's going to be late. Like ever.
I mean, you have to be like a really bad excuse.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. why are you late? Oh, the traffic. Well, there's no traffic.
Traffic doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, yeah. The map. There's no. You don't need a map.
The dog ate me driverless car.
Yeah. No one's caught speeding. No one gets run over.
Yeah. Drink driving doesn't matter. Drink as much as you like, Mush.
Oh yeah.
Unless, of course, you put in the wrong thing into your driverless car because you're so pissed
that
you're like,
chaotic.
Oh fuck! I ended up in Aberdeen, and I don't know how. I just fell asleep. I put it in. I fell asleep, and I ended up in Aberdeen. It cost me loads of money, but at least I could get home because I just put in home again when I got there.
We're just gonna get pissed, aren't we?
Yeah, I think this. Sounds great. ISIS won't. I think they're not going to be.
Of course.
They're not all up for that sort of drunk driving of driverless cars.
It's probably why they've got it.
Mm.
There you go. It's going to change the world.
It is going to change the world, but in ways in which we probably can't even imagine, Joe Ball. Right, let's play a song and we'll come back and we'll talk some more stuff from the papers. Let's a bit of Rolling Stones, I think. This is Gimme Shelter. It's Free by Radio. It's 10:28.
Bar Radio.
Edgy. Oh, isn't that edgy? That was one of our new FUBAR stings as well. for young people, FUBAR Radio, 10:33 for the young. I don't even know what that was. House, I think. Unless it's Happy Hardcore, I don't know. I don't know what it is. Anyway, I'm here with Joe Boar, who's we've been going through the papers. Joe, you mentioned you've done some stuff on TV. You know, you told that. Did you find that text message, by the way? You've still not found
it? Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Have you found it? Yeah.
I was going to call you tonight to talk to you. Just want to start by saying it's nothing to do with anyone else, honey. I'm not seeing anyone. The last few days I've just been feeling really weird about everything, as my head is in such a mess at the moment. I don't know my own feelings, which to me, so I'm not ready to have another person in my life like that right now. You're such an amazing person, and I think so much of you, and I just don't want to hurt you. I know I'm feeling like this, I will, and it's not fair on you because you're lovely. I really hope we can still be friends, as I still like you in my life. But of course, I understand if you don't. I'm really sorry, honey. I'm just going through a really weird time, and it's unfair to drag you down with me. Then she ended with a frowny face.
Did you get a kiss?
No, not even a kiss.
Not even a kiss.
But you know what? I did. I read that out at a gig, and this guy came up to me. A French guy came up to me. And he went, "Actually, I've been dumped by text. Would you like to hear it?" And he sent me one, and it's so much better. This is his one. "Listen, you seemed like a nice guy, but you acted like an asshole. I have one already, and don't need another." So good, isn't it?
And so assholes are like opinions. We've all got one. But let me ask, that's quite a good text. I wouldn't like it, obviously, but I wouldn't mind to be dumped by a text as funny as that.
Yeah, I suppose. Really? Would you think it's funny, though, if you're that close to it?
You probably would. I mean, you know, you've got to see the humour in the, like the gallows humour in the sort of negative. Yeah. I mean, if you don't, you'll kill yourself, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
but you've done some TV stuff. You read that out on a TV show. You've just done a Talking Heads show for Channel 4?
Channel 4.
What is it?
I think it's called Arnold Schwarzenegger's Favourite Stunts, and Arnie presents it. Mate, I haven't seen it yet. It hasn't been out yet. It's going to be incredible. It is good. I mean, not just because I'm on it, and Joey Essex is on it as well.
But, I mean, this is BAFTA stuff. The big, you know, BAFTA winning stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. They sent me 30 stunts, and I thought, I don't know if I want to watch it. And then they were just incredible. There's one, Tom Cruise, Mission Impossible, and he holds onto a plane. He's on
that
the outside
amazing.
Of a plane
in real life.
In real life. He does it 8 times as well. He does it 8 times.
And he does all his own stunts.
He does his own stunts. He sings the theme tune.
Right, the theme tune. Actually, I was at a Channel 4 dinner with a woman called Michaela Coel. Okay. I don't know if you know that. Where no, she did Bubble Chewing Gum Dreams. Chewing Gum Dreams is a Channel 4 sitcom.
Oh, yeah,
An E4
yeah.
sitcom. They've just been recommissioned for a second series.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I sat next to her. We had a great time all night. And and she said to me, "Yeah, no, I wrote it. I'm in it." And yeah. I also, you know, wrote the theme tune.
No.
I was like, "What?" Wrote the theme tune, sing the theme tune.
Did
she was
say
like,
that to her?
Yeah, I know, yeah. Oh, no. Yeah, she didn't mind. She was quite funny, and we got on really well. And getting on really well, giving us sort of like, you know, media advice and saying, you know, this and that, you're going to be a big star. You have to go on my FUBAR show. She was like, "Oh yeah, 100%. I'll definitely do it." Got a number, everything like that. Texted her, "Yeah, a bit busy now, so I'm not coming on." I was like, "Oh right, fine."
Classic.
Well, she shouldn't have told me all those secrets, should she? There you go. So when's that going to be on?
So I think a couple of months. Yeah.
Right.
And Channel 4.
What was your favourite stunt?
My favourite stunt, the Felix Baumgartner, Baumhauer, the one where he jumps from space.
Yeah, that's not really a stunt, is it? I mean, it is. But, I mean, it's not a movie. Oh, it's done that to be a movie stunt.
No, it's just a stunt. There's lots of ridiculous ones where they're like Eddie Kidd, and you know they go over buses.
Yeah, yeah,
they drive
yeah.
over buses, and
not the one where he. Ended up paralysed.
No, yeah. I haven't seen that one. But yeah.
It would be weird if that was your favourite.
Yeah.
What, that one where he ended up in a wheelchair? The rest was like, "Oh, I love that one."
Why are people surprised when they get hurt?
Yeah.
I never understand.
Well, it's also, yeah, so I say this about, like, you know, people who die in helicopter crashes or someone who dies on the slopes. Never likely to happen to me because I don't go in helicopters
and I
don't go skiing. You know.
Just know, everyone I know who's been skiing has broken their leg.
Yeah.
So I just don't, yeah.
And it's, and they're all, you know, they're all rich people's deaths, aren't they?
Yes.
You know, you haven't got any cancer state people dying in a helicopter crash.
You never hear a geezer go, I
left
ankle.
The boozer and I got in my helicopter.
Slid down the snow, do you know what I mean?
Got in a helicopter.
Beer in my hand.
It was a nightmare. Ended up in a massive crash. Everyone died. Nightmare. You don't hear Look. That so much. You. So, yeah, that's what I always think. You know, one way of staying out of a helicopter crash.
Don't go in helicopter.
Don't go in helicopter. Yeah, simple as that. You know, right, so it's a mantra and a rule for life. Yeah. And I think it's useful and people should listen to it. Another talking of stupid idiocy.
Yes.
Donald Trump.
Donald Trump.
They don't get bigger or stupider than Donald Trump, do they, really?
America's Boris.
He's worse.
I mean, they do it bigger, though, don't they? So they've basically got Boris and they've Americanized him.
Yeah, even sort of like the wig. it looks a bit like Boris, but Boris's is all real. You know,
I actually think Boris is just a normal guy. And he walks out of his house just like, oh, God, another day I've got to act like a div for another day. And they're like, Boris, do the voice. Oh, yeah, sorry.
His hair as well. It's like...
It's not... I mean, that has to be deliberate.
Yeah, no yeah, one, yeah, yeah. Because it's ridiculous. And it's like, well, this is really unmanageable. I'm going to just get a haircut. But everyone knows Boris and his stupid straw hair. So they stick with it. Donald Trump, they were debating in the Commons yesterday whether he should be allowed over to the UK or not, given his inflammatory comments about banning Muslims from the United States. And the reason they were debating this in a chamber, I think it was only like 40 MPs there, most of them left quickly, in a little room in Westminster Hall, not even the Commons Chamber, was because there was a petition online which 100,000 people plus signed. So, you know, when you get put together one of these petitions, you only need 100,000 people to say yes to it, and it gets debated in Parliament, it's a pointless debate because, you know, say, for instance, Theresa May wasn't there. There's an interesting sketch by Michael Deacon in The Telegraph today, who says it was pointless because it didn't attract any MPs. Nobody present actually had the power to ban Trump, because that would be a decision for the Home Secretary, who wasn't present, in any case, doesn't want to ban him. And the worst bit, though, was that the debate was broadcast on US TV. Now the Americans have seen this, we'll never be able to affect intellectual superiority over them ever again. Which is interesting. And there are all these, I mean, whether you agree with Boris, whether you agree with Donald Trump coming in or not, they're the same, interchangeable. These petitions do seem largely pointless, don't they?
Well, obviously, the things you just said.
And it's easy to get 100,000 people to sign up to a lot of things.
It is now, isn't it? You used to have to go up to someone in the street and go, can you physically sign it? Now you just click.
Yeah.
Don't you?
A friend of mine, when she was younger, used to do petitions and couldn't be bothered to go around houses, so used to just fill them in herself in different colour pens.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah. Yes. She was quite young. I mean, you know, it wasn't like recently. I've got like a 32-year-old friend filling in petitions in different colours on her own. So, for instance, there was one recently that... You're a freelance, I guess.
Yeah,
self-employed.
Yeah.
We're going to us self-employed are going to have to fill in 4 tax returns a year. Did you know that?
Yeah,
There was a petition, and it slowly crawled to 100,000, but it did get there all the same. And now it's going to be debated in Parliament, the House of Commons, but in one of these little rooms. And I kind of now think, what's the point? I mean, it isn't going to work. I mean, it's not going to. It's not going to affect any change, is it? I mean, it'll just be debated by a few people.
So the petition is to stop the 4.
Well, the petition is just so it gets discussed.
Yeah,
it's nothing. I mean, it's just pointless.
Yeah, I haven't done my tax yet.
In that case, you definitely haven't done the petition.
So I haven't done the petition. I missed the last minute. Well, the thing with Trump, I mean, he is a Wally, but I think rich people, most really rich people, to be that rich, you've got to be a bit of a Wally. I saw a show the other day called Rich Kids of Instagram. Did you see it?
No, but I can imagine what sort of twattery was on it.
It was so depressing. They're really popular. People click like to these idiots who are just sort of waving their cash, just like throwing their cash around. It was really depressing. There was one bit where a little guy was filming a video, but he was getting his girlfriend to throw cash at him. He was going, just throw the cash, make me look rich.
So I collect my, I don't know about you, but I collect my loose change in a pot.
That's a little bit different.
Just cover myself in loose change. Take a photo of me, stick it on Instagram.
It's less
rich,
sexy.
It must be at least £35.
It's definitely less sexy.
Yes, it is. Right, let's play another song and then we'll come back and we'll talk. Try and find some more stuff. Before you, Joe Ball, have to go, unfortunately.
Yes, yeah, right.
Well, let's play a bit of Clash. It's The Train in Vain. It's Fubar Radio, 10:43. Know what that is.
Fubar Radio.
Is it called drums or something? Is it called drums? Glitch? What glitch? They're just making this stuff up now, aren't they? Who makes that? That was our Fubar Radio glitch. That's all of them now. I think. Is there another one? There's one more. I think we'll play one
Stings.
More later, which I haven't
Stings.
Heard. A sting that I haven't heard. So we'll play that later. Anyway, it's Tom Latcham here with Joe Ball, the comedian. It's 10:46. He's got to go fairly shortly, but we've got time for a couple more stories.
Yeah.
One of the stories that we briefly mentioned at the top of the show is that Friends Reunited is to close. So basically, it was sold to ITV. Very sad. What are you going to do in your spare time, Joe? I mean, you're always looking up your old school friends, aren't you, on Friends United? Not anymore. Have you heard of Facebook?
I know the Facebook. Aware of the Facebook. Yeah. That's what my mum calls it, the Facebook.
The Facebook.
I like Friends Reunited. It was the first, wasn't it, the first? Was it before MySpace?
Yes, yeah. I think so. It was back in the day. So it was set up in 2000. Wasn't very popular, but after a mention on Radio 2, its popularity exploded. It hit 1 million users and was soon being blamed for breaking up marriages as users ditched their spouses for first loves. And the couple that owned it, the Pankhursts, Steve Pankhurst and his wife Julie, they sold it to ITV in 2005 for £175 million, which wasn't the smartest Amazing. Move by ITV, because then Facebook came about and it sort of ruined it. 4 years later, it was sold again to a publishing firm for £25 million, and sort of basically no one uses it now, and they've decided it's time for it's time to go. Well, that Sun, right, today says, here we look at some of the stories that once made Friends Reunited our most popular social network. Oh, this will be nice. Wonder what those stories are. Stabbed over first love.
No.
Lags coke brag. So, so this one was particularly stupid. A man working in a seafront amusement arcade earning £45 a week boasted on Friends Reunited of being rich thanks to cocaine deals. The brainless criminal wrote, I'm doing very well. I'm selling a lot of Charlie and Red Car and I've got three sports cars.
And he got fired.
Yeah, he was jail for 3 years.
Wow.
Yeah, stupid.
Yeah, what an idiot. I know there's a comedian who on MySpace put an update or whatever it was, saying, oh, I do these terrible gigs, and sort of named the company the venue of the terrible gigs that he does, and now he doesn't work for him anymore.
Oh dear.
Like, what an idiot. I mean, he obviously, you know, those people would obviously see his MySpace. Not anymore. I don't, does MySpace still exist?
It does exist as a, I mean, it's there.
Yeah.
But I don't know that it exists as a you know, a useful platform where anything happens.
Murdoch boy, didn't it? Murdoch.
£500 million, yeah. And then almost
Tom is laughing.
Almost instantly. what's Tom doing these days?
Still looking for friends.
Fuck all. Yeah. That's what he's doing. Nothing.
Count his money. He's on Instagram throwing the money at his face.
He has got a few quid to throw around,
yeah.
Unless he spent it all on other things. did you ever use Friends Reunited before? But I used to use it as a journalist tool when I was sort of looking for people who, you know, when I was early days of journalism, early days of journalism, I would use it to track people down, you know, who were in the news, and try and find people that they knew from their school, etc.
Yeah.
But then Facebook came about and it was a far more useful tool, really.
Yeah. I think Friends Reunited was more for my mum, like, and my dad. They wanted to, you know, I was in school. And you know,
you were in school in 2000.
I was at,
oh yeah, you probably were.
College.
How old are you?
I was at college.
Yeah, college, yeah. You don't really want to say, if I just want to see my old school friends, I'll just go and see them.
Yeah, they're just there.
I hate them now. I don't really want to see them now, particularly. But they're, you know,
I miss reunions. Do you know what I mean? No one has a reunion anymore, do they? No one. You don't have to. You I think we used to go to reunions because we wanted to see what they're, you know, how they're doing.
But I've got a reunion. Coming up in next July, this July rather, for my university, for all my uni friends that used to live in halls, because it's 10 years on now.
Yeah, but what's
God,
the point,
makes
mate?
Me sound old.
Just go on Facebook, have a look, see what they're doing. That's all you want to know. You want to know if they're doing better than you.
I mean, they almost all certainly are.
Oh, no.
Well, you know, I mean, most people are. So, you know, I'd assume that my friends on Facebook were as well. I mean, you know, you try and meet up with them, but, you know, life gets in the way, I suppose. So if you know, we booked it in 6 months in advance. It was very sweet. A friend of mine was like, I can't wait for this. But he's a dad. You see, when you have a kid,
you what,
like you start looking forward to really banal shit 6 months in advance.
I was on my stag do, and it was like, spot the dad, because the dad on my stag do was like, we've got to go mental. We've got to have it. And you're like, mate, it's just a night. Like, chill out.
That's
like,
going to be
one night.
That's going to be you in
this
6 months.
One night. Yeah,
that'll be you in 6 months. You're like desperate to get away from your strangely named child.
It's like, Milo is a nice name.
In retrospect.
On reflection.
On reflection.
It is like now, you do kind of think, oh, it's lovely being out. I love the air. You start like loving fresh air.
Ridiculous. I love the sound of a baby not crying.
Silence. It's like Louis CK's got that lovely thing about, he says the best time of his day when he closes the door and has to walk round to the other door of his car. I've butchered Louis CK's routine, but I totally agree with that now. My moment is I'm on the toilet. I spend ages on the toilet now.
Maybe that's why dads, you know, dads always, don't they? Like, I don't know, but my dad used to take the paper. To do
that's why they
to do
the
a dump.
Paper.
That's what, because that is their time, and there's 15 minutes of really stinky their time.
Mate, I've got all the supplements, all the papers.
It stinks, but it's better than being out there. So you wouldn't want to be this family who are in the Sun today, who are Britain's biggest family, Sue Radford and Baker husband Noel. They are expecting child number 19.
Ridiculous.
Yeah. Absolutely no need for it in the current, in modern, you know, we're not living in Victorian Britain where you're going to be supported by your kids. You know, quick, we've got to have loads.
Yeah, you've got to look after me. You think after four, they'd be like, that's... I mean, at some point, you'd be like, that's enough.
Get the snit.
I mean, yeah.
I mean, it says like the family that don't cost us a penny, but I find that difficult to believe. A, because obviously they use the NHS, etc., etc. And also, I'm sure they get child benefit. I know that was... They were trying to cut that at the third, but they haven't done that yet. So they will get child benefit. So to say it doesn't cost us a penny is nonsense.
How big is the house? As well. Like, they must all... I mean, there's obviously... Some of them have left.
They
the
say
house.
They claim no benefits and finance their brew with a successful family-owned bakery near their home. I mean, they'd have to chuck out a cup, quite a few loaves for that. It costs 30,000 quid a year to bring them up. That's including a budget of gifts for £100 a child on birthdays and £100 and £250 at Christmas.
That's a lot of prams.
Each week, they get through 126 pints of milk, 14 boxes of cereal and 28 toilet rolls and 21 loaves, which it doesn't or doesn't say that they steal from their own business. Sue was first pregnant at 14, but the couple were determined to keep baby Chris, and both she and Noel were given up for adoption at birth, but last year she had the eight-month... I don't know. Anyway, whatever. She's basically had loads of kids. I mean,
she must
it's
be,
really irresponsible.
She must be damaged.
It's really irresponsible because you know, in the world, there are too many people. We're overpopulated. You don't need 19 kids. And also, like, I mean, no, I'm not going to go there.
I know what you're saying. I hope she's all right. Let's just.
I hope she's all right. All I say is I'm surprised that she can still get pregnant. That's all.
Incredible. I mean, after one. I don't know how you have to. I bought a pram the other week. And I didn't know what I was doing. I went into Mothercare, and I went in there. And the guy went. The guy went. You don't know what you're doing, do you? This is a guy who worked in Mothercare, and I went. I don't know whether to get three wheeler or four wheeler. It's genuinely pulled me aside. He went, I'll be honest with you. Get four wheeler. And I went, why? And he went, I'll be honest with you. Right, when it gets to 6 o'clock, we close down the shop and we all get in the prams and we have a little race. And the three wheeler just can't hold me. I was like, you're my new best friend.
Well, I don't want that three-wheeler, but, I mean, some three-wheelers might be better. Listen, Joe Boy, you've got to go, mate, because you've got some sort of important business thing to do, attend to, and casting or something. I hope you get it.
Thanks, man.
But thank you for joining us. Will you come again?
Come again,
do the whole thing.
Yeah, I'd love to do it.
All right, top man.
Thanks for having me, mate.
So where's the gig this Friday?
This Friday, the Wheat Chief. Rathbone Place, just off Oxford Street, Friday, 7:30.
And people can follow you on Twitter where?
At Joseph Bohr, B-O-R.
Great. Well, thank you very much. Coming up, we've got Tim Marshall, who is the former Sky News diplomatic and foreign affairs editor. He'll be talking to us all about the situation in the Middle East and Russia and various things like that. Really interesting guy. Knows his onions. He'll be in the studio fairly shortly. And then we'll have Jack Russell, the former England wicketkeeper. He'll be talking to us about the current cracking state of the English national team. Anyway, this is Concrete Schoolyard by Jurassic 5. It's 10:55 here on FUBAR Radio.
We were sitting out on the step, you know.
So what you gonna do around this?
Yeah, man, I'ma go over here and do this girl. I know you got it, man. See what his head is all about.
I'ma say this one time, boy, and that's my word.
We rock the shot to knock fire through the Hindenburg.
The contribution is clear.
You add water to bone
and get the Jurassic vibe on the microphone.
Now if you like the tone
and how the harmony's done
and the sucker MC's die before they begun,
well, I'd like to know if you got the notion,
cause we're number one.
I'm not trying to say my style is better than yours, I'm just on some other shit. I'm all about the beats and the lyrics, so when you hear it, you can feel it. The vibe is energized by the presence of my spirit.
No interference, we persevere. The purpose is clear, we're here to leave your ear hurt and severe. You're lurking in fear, cause we take it back like Robin Loxley, rocking from countryside to spots where hard rocks
be. I often wonder if these oopsies even know how it feels to dedicate their whole life to this mic of steel. It's not about the bill, that's not keeping it real. A lot of tight rappers out here ain't got no deal.
We appeal to the brothers with flow finesse, cause it's the 100-watt bloodshot game of death. Cause we're protected by the covenants of words and beats. Rewind and feel the heat, recline and take a seat.
So let's take it back to the concrete streets. Original beats with real live MCs. Playground tactics, a rabbit and a hat tricks. Just that classic rap shit from Jurassic. Let's take it back to the concrete streets. Original beats of real live MCs. Playground tactics, no rabbit in a hat tricks. Just that classic rap shit from Jurassic.
Now I walk from Transania, earthquake Transylvania, and all the way I kick a hole through the wall of China just to get the right blend.
because I'm schizophrenic of the pen. Wait a minute, I fell into the deep end. You shouldn't have told me the pyramids can hold me. So now a contest is what you owe me.
Pull out your beats, pull out your cuts.
Give us a mic,
what up? And we gon' tear shit up.
I'm on some old and forgotten, sun up to sun down, like picking cotton. The nutty professor, science dropping, rocking Robin's Hood from New York to Compton. Me and my three sons, Jabari, Shakir, and Kasa.
So let's take it back to the concrete streets. Original beats for real live MCs. Playground tactics, no rabbit in a hat tricks. Just that classic rap shit from Jurassic. Let's take it back to the concrete streets. Original beats for real live MCs. Playground tactics, no rabbit in a hat tricks. Just that classic rap shit from Jurassic.
Hey, I'm tuna fish from UNITY. Do or die, anti-Illuminati. Why do the liquid from my vocals make the ghetto start swimming? Forever winning, I'm in it like Metal Law Clifford.
I get goosebumps when the bassline thumps. A sucker MC for style, he had mine for lunch. Mark 7, get you open like an attaché. Briefcase in this case, defeat there is no way.
With tool spinners, cooking a full dinner. Killing the firstborn of lyrical Yule Brynners. Winners at the Academy, rattling your anatomy. Gotta be J5, so kill all your fake flattery.
That'll be the day when labels pay our way. Tune to what you say when MCs come to play.
Confident, cause we take it back like Spinal Tap. Preparing your intellect before your final nap. So
let's take it back to the concrete streets. Original beats for real live MCs. Playground tactics, no rabbit in a hat tricks. Just that classic rap shit from Jurassic. Let's take it back to the concrete streets. Original beats for real live MCs. Playground tactics, no rabbit in a hat tricks.
Got beef, huh? Watch your lot, settle it. I fuck around and arrest your whole development. I'm eloquent when it comes to digital display. I'm ready for the world while you earl off the Tango Ray tactics. My shit's Jurassic. Fingers of death while you exhale and inhale with the deep breath. With my chop suey style, cause I'm a lyrical chef. I get smarter to death, cause I be cooking from here to Brooklyn. Your shit's annoying like fat ass bookmen. On good times when I rhyme, I hit the designated area. I hope you got your shot. Cause this is lyrical malaria. Spreading, beheading fools with the punishment. I live in America, but fuck this government. 150 times over silver lead. While y'all drink the simmer like my rhymes are breastfed. No artificial nipples, I flip the real skills. I thought I told you once I kicked the lyrical windmills. And backspin Benedict strictly for my benefit. I step on toes when I flow, don't get offended. Come and get with it, comprehend it when I kick it. I represent the real from the beginning to the end of it.
FUBAR Radio presents
Doc Brown and Hugh Joseph.
But I've been vegetarian for 5 months now.
Wow.
And I literally just did it for sort of a health choice as well.
Yeah.
Do you know what? I ate some late night dirty chicken and like when I was drunk at like 3 o'clock in the morning. And
what was their name?
What was their name?
Just ask guys.
Just ask guys.
Calm down. All right, leave it, leave it.
That was so much fun. Let's do it again. Right? So I ate some late night dirty chicken.
Oh, what was her name? Cool. Sorry, I think I'm getting another call. I better take
that. I'll just wait here.
Every Tuesday,
Doc Brown and Hugh Joseph.
From 4 p.m. on FUBAR Radio.
Yes, but right now it's me, Tom Latcham, at 11.02, and I'm pleased to say that I'm joined in the studio by Tim Marshall now. He's former Sky News foreign affairs and diplomatic editor, and now he's gone freelance. He says he's too busy. He's doing all sorts of other stuff. He's he can tell us a little bit about that. But the world is a pretty chaotic place, and making sense of the world's many conflicts is pretty tricky. But Tim Marshall, who reported from 30 countries, covered the events of 12 wars in nearly 25-year spell at Sky News, says that without looking at geography, understanding it is almost impossible. And his book, Prisoners of Geography, aims to explain why. But what is geopolitics and why is it so vital in understanding what's going on in the world? He joins us here, and hopefully you can tell us. How are you, my friend?
Top of the morning. Very well, thank you.
Good. You look well. It's cold out, isn't it? You're proper... You're wearing a... I mean, you're probably something you've picked up from your time... Go going around the world to cold places.
Thank you for bringing that in already. No, this neck scarf, which I'm great for radio, this came from Afghanistan with me, but the rest of it's from TK Maxx.
TK Maxx in Kabul.
One day. Not this century, though.
And so, what are you doing now? You've left Sky News. You've had 25 years there, which is pretty good, impressive going by anyone's anyone's imagination. What are you up to now? What sort of stuff are you doing?
A whole bunch of stuff. I mean, the shorthand is that I'm earning half as much, but we've got twice as much time to spend it in. Let's have a think. A wee bit of presenting on LBC Radio.
Yes.
Which is where I started, actually, 30 years ago.
The Paris bureau chief, were you?
Yeah, well, it was me and a typewriter, but yeah, you can call
it. Listen, you always fluff up your own achievements. Absolutely, we're a journalist. That's what we do.
Let's have a think. Bit of LBC, a bit of public speaking, a bit of punditry, because, you know, I do have that 30 years experience of travel around the world, and so I do try to... go on various outlets and say, look, this is my take on the French election, the Iranian nuclear deal or whatever. And then I've just started yesterday my fourth book, which should come out later this year. No, I'm not going to tell you what it's about, because I think you should write it and then talk about it before, not talk about it and then write it.
And when's that going to come out, do you think?
September.
Ah, great. And you can
come if out. I write it.
Are you going to write it?
Yes.
What is it? Is it daunting, the idea of writing a book? Sitting down to go, right, I'm going to do this. This is going to basically take me out of the game for several months.
It is, because you don't know how good it's going to be. You know it's a lot of work. But, you know, if you enjoy putting words together, and I do, and I do know something about the subject matter, but I'm going to do a lot of research and learn a lot. I mean, for example, for the last book about geopolitics, obviously I knew a reasonable amount, but I learnt an awful lot in doing the in-depth research for the book.
And so what is geopolitics for those who don't know?
Well, there's a whole bunch of different interpretations. Mine is pretty simply that it's about geography. Geopolitics basically is the kit and caboodle, the whole lot. It is the geography, the politics, the history, the language, the religion, the whole kit and caboodle. But what I did for Prisoners of Geography book was simply to look at topography, the geography. These rivers, these mountains, these deserts have all gone up to make the place the shape it is, and because of that shape, your decision-making is actually limited. And the classic example is Russia. Two things. It's why I open with Russia. If you've been invaded in that flat land in front of you seven or eight times in the last couple of hundred years, and if the narrow corridor between the Baltic Sea and the Carpathian Mountains is 300 miles wide, you will seek to push up to that area, which is Poland, and seek to defend Russia there. That explains all these wars. Well, partially explains all the wars that they've had. They seek to dominate the flat land in front of them. Second, if your ports freeze for half the year, as they do in the Arctic, and you've only got one warm water port, and it happens to be in Ukraine, in Sevastopol, you will annex Sevastopol when push comes to shove, which is, again, a geographical explanation of the politics of the news, excuse me, that we see on the TV. And
they want to build a Donald Trump-style wall. That might help. Rather than sort of, you know, just annexing Crimea, they should just build a big, massive wall and then get over it. I mean, actually, I'm joking, but what did intrigue me about your book is, for instance, what you say about India and China, the two biggest countries in the world. They've never had a war with each other. And the reason you say is because of the Himalayas. Now, going on from that silly wall joke, technology in the world means that surely things like the Himalayas or other geographical potential barriers of geography will become obsolete in currently and in the future.
Well, they're not. They may. I mean, I do argue, technology bends the prison bars of geography. But if you go back to India, China, okay, I challenge you to put an armoured division of tanks over the Himalaya.
They might struggle up the Himalayas.
Which of these mountain passes at 25,000 feet covered in snow and rock are you going to put your armoured column through? And if you're only going to put a few foot soldiers it is a massive wall between these two great powers. They did have an artillery duel in the 70s, lasted about a month, and they both thought this is just,
over the Himalayas,
this is just pointless. Because I mean, they have border disputes now. when we fast forward to the future, yeah, technology means that they're both putting proper navies out there into the oceans. And yes, they might bump up against each other. And yeah, you can fly over the mountains now, but still, the geography determines the relationship between them. They've never looked or glared across that wall at each other. They've always thought, you know what, that's too high.
Mm.
And they've looked elsewhere.
Mm. And regarding that changing nature of conflict with the technology of you know, warcraft, etc., there's currently at the moment debate going on in the Labour Party, but also in the wider country about nuclear weapons and Trident in particular, about whether we renew Trident, which is our sort of nuclear programme. What I'm interested to know is that the time when we had developed these was after World War II, right?
Yep.
So obviously you had, it was a very different situation to what currently exists now. You know, the Cold War, the idea of Russia creating nuclear weapons, so you did, and you know, and it's all the deterrent. But actually, are they quite, in this current world where actually we see the Middle East is a bit of a, is a perhaps bigger concern for us, are nuclear weapons as vital as they once were?
You're talking about MAD, mutually assured destruction, and that's what arguably kept the peace between Russia and America, because they both knew it would be MAD to do it, because they would both be destroyed. Now, in this modern world, when we're putting a lot of money into special forces and flexible and agility, you think, well, what is the point? Mr. Corbyn makes the point that, you know, it is obsolete and no use. I think that's a narrow view. I think that you need to project ahead 5, 10, 15, 20 years, and you don't know what's coming around the corner.
Right.
Now, you might think this is totally nuts, having a nuclear weapon, when you think about what it does. But there is this whole argument that it actually has helped keep the peace. And you don't know if a North Korea is around the corner. We don't know about a resurgent Russia. I'm not convinced about the Iranian deal, etc., etc. Now, that doesn't mean that I want to have a nuclear war, but it is a weapon in your armory of threat. It might be crazy. You can make the case for it. And we're having that debate now, and the money's running out. Personally, I think it has helped the United Kingdom have a voice in the world. And then you can go on to the whole debate, Tom, about, do you want to be Sweden in the 21st century? Because it's not bad over there. You know, Volvo, ABBA, decent standard of living. It's not bad.
They're the two best things that you can come up with for living in Sweden.
Biggest exports they got, but I digress. No, you mean, maybe Britain, this small island off this massive continent, maybe we should go forward and be Sweden. Counter to that argument is, if you want to be a player and have a big voice in the world and shape events to better suit you in the national interest, then you need to be up on the Security Council, possibly a nuclear armed power, and you need to be a player on the world stage. So, you know, that's the debate we're having, and Mr. Corbyn and this new politics is part of that.
But Mr. Corbyn would have said this regardless of the world threat, given that he's been against nuclear arms for 30 years and is, you know, plus, and is also, you know, on the Stop the War coalition, etc., etc. Is he now just using the state of the world as a sort of excuse for trying to get through something that is a long held belief anyway?
I think it's a legitimate position to say, I am totally against nuclear weapons and I want to get rid of them all. I mean, you know, I understand that argument. I just think that unilateralism, which is where he is, you know, we're the only ones that are going to do it, I just don't think that's a particularly good idea. And, you know, of course, you know, some of your listeners will be thinking, oh, you terrible warmonger or whatever. I'm not. I've seen enough of war not to like it very much. You mentioned Stop the War. Now that I'm no longer a full-time news journalist, I'm entitled to have opinions, which I always did suppress in my other job. But I'm afraid I'm not mad keen on Stop the War, because they're misnamed. They seem to like all sorts of wars. They pick and choose which wars they don't like, and they have a pretty narrow worldview, I find.
That's sort of the argument of them from the sort of right.
I'm not right or left.
But that is a sort of an argument that is put forward about them, that they sort of don't mind the wars so long as it's not the UK being the aggressors or whatever.
They obsess about Israel. Sorry, that was my headphones going onto the floor. I waved my arms around passionately. They obsess about Israel to the detriment of other conflicts where more people suffer, which they ignore. They seem to excuse things like the annexation of Crimea because it's Russia, and they've got this old-fashioned idea that just because it's Russia, therefore it's left-wing, therefore it's near where they are, even though he's actually a right-wing gangster state. And they don't care about all... And then when Russia bombs in Syria, they're quiet. But when the British have minimal bombing in Syria, they just shriek and shout. So I just find it a little bit disingenuous, and that's being gentle.
Let's play a song. You chose... we're talking going from war to a love song. Well, or a sex... Marvin Gaye?
This is old school. I defy anyone under 30 not to still like it, even if I'm an old git.
This is Marvin Gaye, What's Going On. Tim Marshall's here. He's trying to tell us what's going on, but, you know, we'll see.
Brother, brother, there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the end. For only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love and get here today. Oh, picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see.
Radio. It's Tom Latchmere. I'm here with the former Sky News diplomatic editor and foreign affairs editor, Tim Marshall, who's been talking to us about, all of that, really. And his book, Prisoners of Geography, which is a great read and well worth reading. At the moment, as we've mentioned slightly earlier, the Middle East is a big threat to world peace, I suppose, and world security and our own national security. In terms of geography, how come the Middle East is so volatile and is such a tricky prospect for the West, inverted commas, to deal with?
There's a number of reasons, and some of them go back to our colonial past, and you know, there is a degree of responsibility there. So if we start with that, for example, if you look at Iraq, there was no such country as Iraq. It's a made-up word. And then when the Turks had their empire, the Ottoman Empire, they ruled the top part of it because they saw it was mountainous and full of people that spoke Kurdish. Okay, well, that's that area. And the middle bit was mostly Sunni Arab Muslims in the flat desert lands, and they thought, well, that's another area. And then the bottom of it was mostly Shia. I mean, this is very broad brush stuff. And they ruled that as, and they called them Vilayats. That's Vilayat 1, Vilayat 2, Vilayat 3. And then the Brits came along and said, well, actually, you know what? You're all one people. And they said, you know what? And we're going to draw a line here. And if you want to go across that line, you have to have a piece of paper. And everyone's saying, excuse me? So, this, you know, a tribe, let's say, in part of Iraq that had very close relationships 100 miles away with a tribe in what is now Syria, suddenly some bloke from Europe who doesn't speak their language is telling them they need a piece of paper to go across that. It's nuts. And to forge national unity in just 70 or 80 years, it's pretty difficult. We've seen that in Libya. There was no such country as Libya. That was ruled as two various different areas. So we have imposed that artificial structure upon those areas, and that, okay, they're trying to make a fist of it, and it's fallen apart.
Is that why we're seeing the rise of a group like IS? Because they don't see borders in the way that we do, So they spread to wherever they need to and are trying to effectively create a caliphate, which existed under the Ottoman Empire.
And existed 1,000 years ago and 1,300 years ago and 800 years ago. And then for 100 years ago, no, it doesn't exist anymore. So, of course, there's going to be elements that want to recreate that and who don't believe in these borders, because it's not a national, a nation state like in the, you know, our borders are pretty well defined as a sea. You know, you go far enough and there's some water, you know that's the end. They didn't have that. But you asked in general about why it's unstable. So you've got that. You've got poverty and a geography that doesn't lend itself to actually making a lot of money. Brief example, Egypt and Britain. Britain, loads and loads of trees. Chop them down, build a massive navy, get out there. Egypt, no trees, no navy. Can't get out there. We can trade. Europe, long flat rivers, grow some crops, get them down the river. This is Jared Diamond's theory of it's called Guns, Germs and Steel. Wonderful book. So the Middle East hasn't got that. Now, it has got the oil, which is pumped. Well, some of them have, but some of them haven't. Then you, on top of all that and that poverty, you then have a huge, huge population growth. Most people are under 35. You haven't got jobs, so you're looking elsewhere. And if I'm going to get really controversial, you then inject a strain of Islam. This is not about Islam. It is about a strain of Islam. You inject that rather virulent strain called Wahhabism and other philosophies into all that and into all that instability, saying this is the answer to all your problems. And it's we're hearing the echo of it now.
And are IS as big a threat as, for instance, the British government, the American government, would like you and I to believe, or are they one of many groups that, like Al Qaeda, will eventually burn out?
They will.
And how long? When will they burn out?
I mean, within 2 years.
You think so?
Yeah. I mean, but it'll be AQ3. I mean, we had Al Qaeda one,
right,
with Osama. This is pretty much AQ2. I mean, in fact, they used to be Al Qaeda in Iraq. Then they changed their name. They became what we now know as ISIS. They will be destroyed, and then there'll be another one because it's about the ideology.
Well, in that case, what are we how do we tackle it?
Well,
or do we?
Well,
I mean, if people want to live under these conditions, should we let them? I mean, this probably isn't going to happen.
You deal with it with great sensitivity and brutality simultaneously, which is a pretty difficult thing to pull off.
Yeah.
So the Americans call it whack-a-mole. I mean, you know, you whack one on the head and it's going to pop up somewhere else, but you can't not whack it on the head because otherwise they'll be popping up simultaneously everywhere. So that's containment, which is what's happening at the moment. You then try and deal with the root causes, which is things like poverty, but which is also the ideology. And that's the bit that we're not handling very well. I mean, I'm not sure what I think about it. Cameron's come out with this new thing about veils in schools. That is actually all part of how you deal with this new reality, this new relationship. And that's what I meant about with great sensitivity on one hand, with great brutality on the other hand. And it is a generational thing. So to answer the question, no, they're not. Look, if you lived in the Democratic Republic of Congo, the DRC, 6 million people have died there in the last 20 years of war. 6 million. I mean, that's... When you know, what is more a threat to human life and existence? That is. This is something that is not what's called an existential threat. It's not going to overthrow the country. What I do worry about in the long term, Tom, is that the more we sacrifice our liberal values, which I personally quite like, whether it's gay marriage, this, you know, whatever it is, all that stuff that we've grown up with in Europe, built on the riches of our empire, you know, I'm well aware of all that, but I'm not a self-hating Westerner, and there's a lot of self-hating Westerners about who just loathe everything about us, and they seem to side with other people. If we give in to people that say, I demand the right to behave in an illiberal way, if we are tolerant of intolerance, that will change our entire society. And again, I go back to this thing about great sensitivity. You have to deal with it with such sensitivity, but not back down when people start shouting at you.
Jeremy Corbyn said was ridiculed over the weekend for saying that we should be talking to IS. And I've started reading a book. I haven't got that far into it, by Jonathan Powell, his book is called Talking to Terrorists, and says that we always end up talking to terrorists anyway. Has Jeremy Corbyn got a point? Should we be talking to them? Are we talking to them?
As far as I know, we're not. We don't have the channels of communication. And the problem is there isn't that much to talk about. Now, no, really,
well, no, but it's difficult. As Stuart Lee makes a joke, I don't know if you've seen, where he says, you know, it's difficult. With the IRA, they were gentlemen terrorists. You know, they had set our goals and names.
And they even rang you up.
They'd ring you up and tell you they were bombing.
Not always.
But IS, you know, with Al-Qaeda, he made the joke about, but it's IS now. It's difficult to get around the table and to discuss how to come up, you know, live up to their aims of the destruction of all Judo-Christian society.
Right. Jonathan Powell, former Blair advisor, wrote an article in The Atlantic and followed it up with a book. And he says, yes, we do always end up talking. This is true. Mr. Corbyn has made that point, and he talks about the Northern Ireland example. It is totally irrelevant, the Northern Ireland example. You are dealing in Northern Ireland. You were dealing, to an extent, are people who have boundaries and ideals and are prepared to compromise in order to achieve them with a set objective. The set objective of Islamic State is to kill every single person that disagrees with them, of whatever flavor they are. It doesn't matter if they're cross worshippers, Christians, beef worshippers, which is what they call the Hindus. You know, they're pretty much against everybody. And secondly, to expand the caliphate, eventually worldwide, but certainly to take back every single inch of territory which was ever under Islamic rule. Well, that's most of Spain. And they're on record as wanting all that. How much of Spain do you want to negotiate away?
Not the one where all the Brits live. We've got to keep the Costa del Sol.
That's exactly the bit they want. No, but
they can have it. They won't like it there, to be fair.
It's a platitude to say, oh, yes, we must negotiate, and you always end up negotiating. It's just too simple. We haven't seen this before. In 1945, were you going to negotiate with Hitler about the percentage of Jews he wanted to kill? Or were you just going to say, we stand against this?
Yeah.
That was total war. We accepted it was total war. This actually is total war.
Right. There was a interesting sea change about 2 years ago when David Cameron, he wanted to bomb Assad. And he lost, because Assad was accused of using chemical weapons on his own people. And he lost the vote to bomb Syria at the time. There was a point in time where Assad stopped being the enemy and IS suddenly became the enemy. It was difficult to pinpoint exactly when that happened, but you started seeing stuff in the papers more about IS and less about Assad. And you know, and then, obviously, he won a vote recently to bomb ISIS in Syria. Do you think David Cameron really understands the minutiae of Middle Eastern politics and the intricacies of its very tricky history?
No. But he's paid to have people around him that do and give him, hopefully, the best advice. Now, obviously, if you know, if your own politics then comes into it, if you see people making five decisions that you disagree with because you're politically over here, you think they're getting terrible advice. If you agree with them all because of your politics,
But the fact, you know, and I can stand aside from that, from my politics of who I believe or who I don't believe, or what, you know, whether I'm left or right, and just see that he literally turned on a sixpence.
Yeah.
Not literally.
Well,
turned
I'll
on
tell
a,
you why.
He turned on sixpence, and you think. Do you understand?
What's a sixpence, Tom?
I don't know.
I'll tell you why it happened. Enough people came to him and said, look, this guy, Assad, is a bad person. However, he's not a threat to us. He doesn't want to cross any borders. He doesn't want to go into Jordan. He doesn't want to do this. He doesn't want to do that. He doesn't want to come to London and blow people up. We tried to do something about him and utterly failed, and so did with a complete lack of leadership from Obama as well. Then along come this nihilistic end of days nutters, ISIS, who do want to cross borders, that are trying to get a worldwide franchise, that will go after Brits in Tunisia and kill them in the beaches, etc., etc., etc. And he was persuaded that this lot are actually a greater threat to this country and its interests and its friends such as Jordan, because Jordan and the UK are very close. Mm-hmm. Consequently, okay, as you say, they turned on that old-fashioned coin that went out of usage about 35 years ago. When they first came in, I think my brother... No, it was half... Was it half pence? My brother told me they melted in your pocket, and I should give them to him. What a chancer. Sorry, I digress.
I mean, so should someone like David Cameron not be making better decisions? Do you think that the question is, he was seemed desperate to bomb Syria regardless of who he was bombing. Do you think there's something in that he wanted? All great leaders over time have been involved in wars. You know, Thatcher.
Not Gandhi.
No, but, you know, British prime ministers have been involved in wars, and their legacy is decided on how well they went. Do you think that he just kind of had that in him, that he just wanted to be involved in a war?
Well, he had it with Libya. And then he walked away. I was in Benghazi when he stood up there and he said, we will stand shoulder to shoulder with you, the Libyan people, in your struggle for democracy. And then he walked off the stage, so did everybody else, and left them to it. So he'd had his moment of glory, so I'm not sure he desperately wanted another one. The world is incredibly complicated. Things change. You have to make decisions. And sometimes your decision-making is wrong. No, I don't see him as a bloodthirsty warmonger. I'm not saying I'm a fan, and I'm not saying that everything he does is right. Far from it. I'm not saying that foreign policy decisions are correct. Far from it. But I don't think he grew up thinking, you know what, I really want to bomb people. I think that's a cardboard cutout view. You know, I mean, the whole thing about him being posh and all the rest of it, these are cardboard cutout views of people that doesn't take into account nuances of their whole life experience. It's like, you know, someone who comes from, who wasn't educated might be regarded as thick or whatever because they come from a certain background. That would be unfair. And it's unfair to think that all he cares about is other posh kids.
Well, unfortunately, we've come to the end of our time here. And,
we never talked about football.
I know we didn't. Let's talk briefly about it. I mean, you've got a book called Dirty Northern Bastards. We can say it on there. It's Fubar Radio. It's not Ofcom regulated.
And the back cover's called Soft Southern Bastards.
There you go. So it's not all
it's very balanced, and
it's the story of Britain's football chants. How important are chants to the success of a team, but also the identity of the followers?
They make the game partially what it is. I opened that book with saying something like, if Ronaldo scored a goal in the San Siro, for example, and nobody was there to see it, you know, it's like the old tree falling in a forest. If he scores a goal and there's no one there, did he score? we are what makes the game great, and without us, it's just 11 blokes kicking a ball.
Well, it's increasingly now a TV sport. That's where the money is. But
yeah,
do you
when
think
was the last time you watched a match on telly when there was hardly anyone in the stadium?
Sometimes
it's flat.
Sometimes the when the Champions League games,
it's awful. They're banned. So where what makes it, and our chance of what makes it, now obviously within those chants there's some terrible, disgusting stuff which I take on and I'm against, and I personally don't join in. I go home and away still. When, one of the reasons I gave up my job is because I can see my team a lot more.
You're a dirty Leeds fan, aren't you?
it's one of our chants. We're quite proud of it. We revel in being dirty Leeds. And that's the thing about going back to the original point, Tom, about identity. It is a way of using your identity and feeling affinity in a modern world where we are cut off often from our roots. And, you know, football is a way of getting back to your roots. Now, obviously, there's X, Y, and Z that take it too far. Mm. And you know, there's all sorts of chants which, you know, just utterly, utterly disgraceful. But there's also that fantastic British wit, humour, absurdity. Lee Novak scores for Huddersfield and they say, "We've got Novak. Our carpets are filthy. We've got Novak." I mean, it's, you know, it's comedy gold. It's end of the pier stuff and we absolutely love it. I just wish people wouldn't fight at games.
Yeah. Well, Leeds.
Tell me about it.
Well, I've got to say, of the many anthems, you know, Bubbles at West Ham, the one that I have always found the most...
Marching On Together?
Yeah, by the Leeds
Marching
United.
On Together, written was
when
written
the whole crowd is singing it, there, it goes right through you, and you're like, oh dear, the blimey, this
written
is
written by the same guy that wrote Delilah for Tom Jones.
Really?
Fact.
Maybe you should write a Bournemouth one, because I always think that the atmosphere at our games is slightly lacking.
I was there last season, Bournemouth Leeds, and we beat you 3-0.
So yeah, quite. The atmosphere was probably lacking from our end.
Look,
but
it's a cracking stadium. I really like the club, and God willing, they stay up.
Yes, I think so too. Tim Marshall, thanks for joining us. Your books, Prisoners of Geography and Dirty Northern Bastards, The Story of Britain's Football Chance, they're both out now, and you can find them. And you can follow you on Twitter, where at?
iTwittius.
iTwittius, there you go. We tweeted that out as well, so you can follow. Anyway, we'll play one of your final song that you chose, Arctic Monkeys, A Certain Romance.
A popular beat combo from Sheffield, which...
Not Leeds, only Leeds. You should have said Kaiser Chiefs, really. That's what you should have said.
I predict a riot. No, but look, it's a cracking song. It reminds me of growing up.
Well, thank you very much, Tim, for joining us. I hope you might come again sometime. Good luck with your new book.
Thank you very much.
All the best, matey. This is Football Radio, it's 11:34.
The minds are made up, and of course it's all okay to carry. it might overstep the line, but you just cannot get angry in the same way. No, not in the same way.
You rate the drivers, but also they rate you. But because they rate you, you can actually find out, right? So I'm going to go and do mine. Okay, mine says your average trip rating is 4.6 stars. What is yours?
4.8.
That's good. That's better than mine, mate.
Yeah, but it should be 5.
Mate, that's really good. How many times have you used it?
I've used it probably about 25 times. What? If I've done 25 journeys, at least 4 people have marked me down a star.
Wow, it's like Edinburgh all over again. It's absolutely furious.
Every Wednesday,
Joey Page,
from 1 p.m. on FUBAR Radio.
That's Joey Page there. I'm Tom Latcham. It's 20 to 12. I've only got 4.5 stars, I think, on Uber. I wonder whether, like, that must mean that one person gave me a 1 or loads of people gave me a 4. And I'm always quite nice, so that's quite baffling. Anyway, right. On the line now is the founder of property website spareroom.com. His name's Rupert Hunt. Rupert recently announced an amazing opportunity where he's offering rooms to rent in his own massive house in London's trendy Spitalfields area on a pay what you can afford basis. I've pitched in. I've said not much, but is it all as it seems? Here he is to tell us now. Hello, Rupert.
Hi, Tom. How's it going?
I'm okay. How are you?
Yeah, good. Thank you.
So, have you found any flatmates? And if you have, what are they paying?
Well, this time round.
How much did you take?
Not yet. Sorry, say again.
How much did you take? How much are you willing, or how little, rather, I should say, are you willing to take on this?
Well, I've been shown by choice for the last 3 years now, and I've done the same thing with my previous housemates, and they've paid anything from nothing to $600 a month. So it really is what it says. I just don't want to limit my options of who I might get to live with by saying you've got to pay market rent, which is going to
a lot
price a lot of people out.
Well, you will get a certain type of person, won't you? If you Spitalfields is a nice place where rich people do live, so you will be sort of getting a certain type of person if you charge market rates, right? What have you found by charging what you can afford? Have you made friends through it?
Yeah, I've made friends through the process of looking for housemates, like people I didn't decide to take in, but I've become friends, and also the people that have lived with me have become friends. It's been an amazing experience.
And do they get all their bills included as well?
Yeah, that's bills included.
Blimey. What's the catch?
I suppose, well, the only catch this time is you've got to be part of a YouTube series, because with or without YouTube, I'd be looking for flatmates again, but it just seemed like a great opportunity to sort of spread sort of this message that I sort of believe in, that living with the right flatmates is better than living on your own.
Hmm. And it's, I mean, you've been doing it for a while, so this isn't what you would say is, you know, a stunt or a PR thing.
No, absolutely not. I mean, like I said, I'd be doing it anyway. But I do want to get publicity out of it because I want to spread this important message. So.
And what are you looking for when you look for a flatmate? And how do you go about finding them? Do you interview them? I had an idea once when we were looking for a flatmate that I would give each person that came round 20 quid and I'd say... Yeah. I'm not going to tell you what to buy, but go and buy something for 20 quid that you think I would like and see, and then see what they came back with. And then you could decide whether they were smart, funny, all that sort of stuff. Not a bad way of looking. How are you doing it?
That's a great idea, actually. I might steal that.
Yeah.
I suppose what I'm looking for, I mean, one of the things I'm going to do this time is I'm going to, once I've narrowed it down to say 10 people, I'm going to invite them to a party. I'm going to ask them to bring a friend of theirs or two, and I'm going to bring my friends because you're inheriting each other's social circles. That's sort of one of the great benefits of it. Mm. And then sort of mix everyone together, see who gets on, because obviously I can't just pick two people I like because they might hate each other, and see what my friends think of them and so on. So that's going to be part of my selection process.
But in many ways, Rupert, you won't know until you actually live with them that they're really messy or whatever.
Well, there is that, and I'm hoping people will be honest with me, because and I'll be honest with them that I'm a little bit messy. So, you know, if you're someone who washes up straight after dinner, you don't want to live with me. I'll drive you mad.
I have got a crack problem. I will sell all your stuff, but I make a cracking spaghetti bolognese, something like that.
Yeah.
And how's your search going so far?
Brilliant. I mean, I love this bit of the search, sort of the messages. It's great. I mean, but I've had a crazy amount this time because it's gone public. So I've had over 5,000 so far.
5,000? Wow.
So I've got my work cut out. I'm not getting much sleep at the moment, sort of working through them all. But I'm going to close applications on Sunday. So people still have time. And then next week I'll start inviting people around.
So you've got 5,000 people. How are you going to cut that down, and what are you going to cut that down to?
Well, one of the things I've had to sort of ask for, I'm not insisting on it, but because obviously they've got a real flavour of what I'm about by seeing my video, and I kind of need to get a similar back from them. So I've asked them to sort of add a video to their profile on the site or send it to me direct, so I get a proper feel from them. And obviously because it's YouTube, it's good to make it more visual as well. So that's sort of helping narrow things down because some people aren't prepared to. I guess that's going to be, yeah.
And it hasn't closed yet. Where can people get involved?
So if you go to Spare Room website, there's a little promotion on there for my series, and you can find my advert through that, and then just apply through Spare Room in the normal way.
Okay, and a bit about SpareRoom.com. You had the idea in 1997. How did it come to be what it is today?
Well, it was 1999. I started a site that became Spare Room. It was a London-only site, and then I moved back to my parents' house in 2004 because I left my job and my girlfriend at the time, and it was then I realised, hang on, this is a nationwide thing people are sharing. So that's when I launched Spare Room, and it was only kind of 3 years ago that I tried my own service, because by the time I had launched Spare Room, I was in a long-term relationship, and you know, so it was almost like falling in love with the business all over again when I kind of discovered how much I enjoyed it and what a positive way to live it is.
Yeah. And is it true that you worked in a supermarket when you came up with the idea?
After university, I'd done a pop music degree, which, as you can imagine, doesn't really have many applications. So I ended up working in Tesco and then started building websites in my spare time and working for free for people and got my experience that way. And then, you know, kept on, you know, building different sites, and eventually came up with Spare Room. So.
And what do you think? What is your view, finally, before I let you go? What's your view on the current rental market, particularly in London?
I mean, it is crazy, and I hear, you know, a lot of resentment amongst young people that are justified. You know, I don't blame them. And so, I guess part of my hope for this is that people see that, you know, even though they might not have a choice at the moment, it is a positive choice and a positive way to live, and perhaps something they might choose to do even if they had the choice to live on their own or buy a property. So And I also hope that by doing this, I'll inspire some more homeowners to rent out rooms and hopefully ease some of the crisis there is. Because in some parts of London, there's maybe 10 people looking for every room.
So if you want to live with Rupert, then people should go to spareroom.com. You've got till Sunday, that's correct, to put in to join the 5,000 who do currently want to live with Rupert. But thank you for joining us, mate. It's been good to talk to you.
Thank you.
All the best. Thank you very much.
Cheers. Bye.
Thank you. Now, Saturday saw the England cricket team wrap up a very impressive series win in South Africa's backyard. And joining us to discuss that and chat about his illustrious career in the game is former England wicketkeeper Jack Russell. He joins us on the line. Hello, Jack. How are you?
Good morning. I'm all right. You okay?
I'm good, thanks. Jack, I've got to say, you're something of a childhood hero of mine.
Why is that then?
Because you were the best wicketkeeper that played for England, right?
And well, that's very kind of you to say that.
And I used to love watching you. And I used to. So my father and my grandfather, both wicketkeepers, and I loved the way you would just stand up fearlessly against fast bowlers without a helmet on.
Well, that's very kind. Do you keep wicket then? Because it must be in the blood.
I absolutely don't. I can't bend down. That's my problem.
Tell me about it.
So, obviously, we've won the series out in South Africa. How impressive was that victory?
Oh, it's brilliant. I don't think, in a way, we sort of made it look a bit easy, but it's actually quite a tough place to go and play. You know, it's they don't give you a lot over there, and they're quite an aggressive sporting nation, so you have to be up for it. I'm a little surprised we won it so easily the other afternoon. That was a bit of a shock, I've got to admit, because I thought we'd be chasing a few more than that. But in other ways, I'm not surprised, because actually we've got a very good team with a good bunch of players that have got lots and lots of talent, and it was a fantastic. And I don't think we played at our best yet either. I think there's still room for improvement. We're still a little bit inconsistent in a certain areas, a few areas. But great to see young Stuart Broad get a few wickets again, and I remember him being about 1 foot long when he was a little baby when he was born, so he's grown into something very special. So I was pleased for him and the rest of the team, because I know they work very hard, and they actually seem a good bunch of lads as well, so they've got a good team spirit going.
And I mean, how pleasing is it to see the likes of Broad and Joe Root dominating the bowling and the batting charts in this way?
Yeah, it's great. I mean, it just goes to show that you know, don't underestimate how good they are. And I think certainly Joe Root's going to get even better when he gets a bit more ruthless, and he's not out 100 overnight and goes and the next day and gets another 100. You know, I think he can go to another level, but he's been absolutely superb in the last year or so. I think he's the leading run scorer, I think, in last year's Test cricket, with a very high average. So he's a special talent and a very level-headed lad. With, you know, he's got a good attitude. And
Broad was obviously just been announced that he's the best bowler in the world currently. Do you think that is true? He is. Do the stats lie, or are their stats true?
Well, I tell you what. If you look at the players that he's got out, he gets good players out. You know, so you've got to be a decent bowler to do that consistently. He did it with the Aussies last year. I think when he gets on a roll, I don't think there are many batsmen in the world that can stop him. And he got Amla, he got De Villiers out again, and you know, he's just a special talent. And when he gets on a roll, he is something special. He's great. Good to see.
He says that he doesn't think he's the best bowler in the world, or even in England. He thinks Jimmy Anderson's better. But do you think that Broad's got it in him to maintain it and stay as the best bowler in the world?
What he probably means is he probably thinks that Jimmy does more with the ball. He probably thinks Jimmy's got more skills. But what Stuart's got, he's got a great attitude. And he's quite tall, you know, he's 6 foot something, and it comes from a difficult height. So in some ways, he's awkward. He's awkward to face against. So I think he's just been a little bit modest and probably just trying to take the pressure off himself a little bit. But don't make no mistake, if you had to face him in the nets, you'd know about it.
Well, there's talent, as you said, through the team. Ben Stokes got 258, I think. Huge score in the first test, or maybe the second. Can he be the next Flintoff, or even surpass Flintoff if he stays injury-free?
Oh, I think he'll surpass Flintoff, certainly with the bat.
What about Botham?
Botham was, in my opinion, the greatest England player of all time, greatest all-rounder of all time, and his statistics show that. But he's got a bit of beefy Botham about him. You know, there's no fear. He doesn't care who he's playing against. He doesn't care. He just sees the ball and he hits it. And he comes, give me the ball, I'll take a wicket. You know, he's just that refreshing attitude that's exactly the same as Ian Botham. Because when you walked out with Beefy next year, you just thought you could beat anyone and take anybody on. You know, he was so fearless. A bit like Darren Goff, you know, play with no shackles, those types of players. But the thing about Ben Stokes is he's great for England because he gives the team lots of balance. You know, with him, he's a batsman and a bowler front line. So it just allows Alistair Cook in the team to have so many options in the bowling department. And that makes us an even stronger team. When you look at that period where we used to play six batsmen, and if we'd played five bowlers, I wasn't playing, so Alec kept wicket. So, you know, it just balances the team out nicely and gives the captain lots of options. He's a captain's dream, and his attitude is so refreshing.
And then Johnny Bairstow recently became only the second England wicketkeeper to take the first four dismissals of an innings in Test cricket. What do you make of him?
I remember little Johnny batting on the boundary with his late dad all those years ago with it. A bat that was so tall it was above his head. You know, I can still see him there now. And just for him to end up playing for England, get his first 100 the other day, his dad would have been so proud of that. And he's a good cricketer. He's got a lot of runs in recent times. Certainly for Yorkshire last year, he had a great season. The batting's not an issue. Same with Josh Butler. Their batting's pretty strong. The keeping, obviously, they're still learning. I always say to people, they've still got nappies on at the moment. They've been doing it for about 2 minutes. So if you speak to your dad, he'll tell you that it takes a long time to work the job out. And, you know, those guys haven't really kept much in county cricket, or certainly Josh Butler hasn't kept a full season. So the keeping's raw, but they will get better, a bit like Matt Prior.
Is it something that does come with age, wicketkeeping?
Well, I think it took me a couple of seasons of county cricket to learn how to work the job out, for starters. You know, you learn out what you need and don't need to do. So, and they're going to make mistakes, and you have to accept that at the moment. But if you look at Matt Prior, was rough and raw when he started, turned out to be the best in the world for a period. And then you've got Alex Stewart, who kept wicket a little bit early in his career, and then the more he kept towards the end of his career was top class. So I think those two, if you stick with them, I've got no fear on the batting and scoring runs. I think they'll both do that. But their keeping's going to be inconsistent for a bit. But the other great thing the thing that doesn't worry me is their work attitude towards the job is first class. So we know they're going to work at it and improve. So they will only get better and better, like a good wine, Tom.
And how much has the role of wicketkeeper evolved since your day? How is it different, if at all?
Well, it's batsmen that keep wicket now. In my time, it was a little bit of a dilemma going on with myself and Alex Stewart. And it started before that, really. Back in the 60s with Jim Parks and people like Alan Knott came along. And you had Bob Taylor, so I'm going way back before your time there, probably. But it's sort of the dilemma's always been there. But now the selectors just go, right, how many runs is he going to score? And then we'll add the keeping on. So that's just the name. And county cricket's like that as well, really. There's a lot of that in county cricket.
So in a way, Jack, you perhaps if you'd have been around today, you might not have seen the success, perhaps, that you did.
I don't hit enough sixes for starters. If I got the ball off the square, it was a result, you know. But no, they play in such. It's not just scoring runs; it's the way they want the keepers to score runs, coming in at seven. So it's a different ball game now, and I might not have played as much, you know. So I'm thankful that I played so many games.
And how's your art going? Because
busy.
Tell us.
Well, I'm just busy. I'm always busy because there's always something to paint, and I've spent the last 2 or 3 years working on a new book where I painted every ground that I played at.
Nice.
For Gloucestershire, which ended up being, I thought it'd be about 30 grounds, but ended up being 70 grounds, 70
grounds. How long did that take?
It took me 2.5 years to do the thing. I thought, well, I'll have it done in 6 months, but no, it took me 2.5 years I thought, well, I'll put all the stories in to go with the pictures, and thought it'd just be a few lines, but that ended up being about 40,000 words. So it's quite a heavy book. But I love doing it, and it's basically my journey through cricket, and right from the very start to the end. So I had some great time doing it, because you go around to all the grounds and it's just to paint the pictures, and there were still the same people sat in the same seats they were like 20, 30 years ago. It was fantastic. It was great to go back and do it all. And I loved every minute.
And where can people find out about the book?
They can get me on, they can find me on Twitter, or they can Jack Russell Art on Twitter. Or they can just look at our website, which is jackrussell.co.uk, straightforward. And all the pictures and the county grounds are on there. And we're still on tour again this year with the book. We're going around to all the grounds that are in the book, so we've still got a few to do. So, I'm enjoying it. It's great. It's good fun.
Very good. I'm glad. You'll have to send us a copy or two, because I'd love that. And I think my granddad would particularly love that. He's a huge county cricket fan, so there you go.
Yeah, yeah. What's your granddad's name?
Robert.
Well, there you go, then.
Bob Latcham.
Right, I'll leave that with me. We can get your address off the website, can't we?
I'll get you my address. Don't worry about that. Listen, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, Jack.
No pleasure. Get young Tyler. Is it Will? Send
Will
me the
producer.
Address.
We'll do. Yeah. We'll do that. Listen, Jack. Thank you so much for joining us. Fascinating stuff.
And pleasure. Anytime.
Hopefully, I'll speak to you again sometime.
Yeah, I look forward to it.
All the best, buddy.
Cheers.
Thank you. Bye. That was Jack Russell, the former England wicketkeeping legend, from his views on the cricket. Now, we've come to the end of the show. Thank you for listening. All those send messages, didn't really get around to reading any, unfortunately, but thank you for getting in touch. I'm sure we were at some point. And thanks to everyone who came on the show, comedian Joe Ball with the papers, author and former Sky News diplomatic editor Tim Marshall, and of course there you just heard former England cricketer Jack Russell, and then also we heard from spareroom.com's Rupert Hunt. Coming up at 4 p.m, Hugh Joseph with special guest host Robbie Knox, I believe. Download my interviews as a podcast from iTunes and SoundCloud. Tom Latcham interviews. Probably put Jack Russell up there. Probably put Tim Marshall up there. Join me again next week, 10 till 12. Hope you've enjoyed yourself. Join me again next week, 10 till 12. It's FUBAR Radio. It's 11:58. This is a play you out with a bit of Stone Roses. See you later. Ta-da.